Tom Wilmer reporting from Templeton, California. Right now, we are out in the sunshine in a field overlooking 80 acres of vines, and we're here with Vic Roberts, the owner of Victor Hugo Winery. Hi, Vic.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for coming out today.
My pleasure. Let's start at the beginning. I understand that you are a UC Davis grad, and you went through the viticulture program ahead of the curve quite a long time ago.
Yeah, so long ago, my kids wonder if there were actually any electricity at the campus when I was there. But no, I actually graduated UC Davis '79. My degree technically is fermentation science, emphasis in enology, also includes beer making and industrial fermentations in the same program. But from there, actually headed out, spent a year in Sonoma after graduation, and then a couple years down in Temecula, and then came to Paso in 82. First winemaking job.
I want to back up even further, though, because it's always a curious thing to me. People like you, you go to high school and you're having fun. And at what point did you start thinking that beer and wine was a part of your world?
Well, like most college students, you think beer is a part of your world almost as soon as you get there. But as far as a career, I was, pre-something or other, like most people at Davis that time, chemistry, bio-sci background. I actually took an introductory course in enology, enology 3, loved it, thought I can do this, think it would be a great career, and actually changed majors almost in about a month of enrolling in the class.
So when you arrived on the Central Coast, I remember you were out in Creston for a long time, right?
15 years, yes. Was hired as the winemaker for a startup winery there. Began in 82, got there in July. We had our first crush that fall. Actually, it was late because it was wet and late. Actually started crushing fruit in October. Pretty small crush. From there, it got bigger. I was there for about 15 years. During that same time period, my wife and I bought a piece of property here in Templeton, actually late 84, old abandoned cattle ranch that had, as far as structures, had a little farmhouse which needed extensive remodeling several times, and an old redwood barn that was an old hay barn. Mountains of junk. Unlike the reality TV shows, we didn't find anything valuable buried in it, just more junk to haul off.
Now, I seem to recall at the time that you and Leslie were, it was a scary move.
It was one of those leap of faith type decisions. Bought a piece of property kind of on a shoestring. In fact, couldn't get conventional financing. Ended up with owner loan, interest only for 5 years with the balloon. And I'm sure the previous owner was pretty convinced he was going to get it back, and it was going to have a little advantage of having had some grapevines planted on it. But things worked out. You know, when the first harvest came in, that definitely helped turn the tide.
Now, that was quite a long time ago in the world of wine growing on the Central Coast. How'd things change? What you thought was ideal to plant then, is it still ideal today?
Originally, we were running it as a vineyard project only. So at that time, we planted what was selling, which was actually a variety that we don't currently make for the winery, Chardonnay. And at that time, it was the variety to plant. And actually, over the course of the last 25 years, we've never had unsold Chardonnay at any time.
So it isn't that Chardonnay is not an optimal plant to place here.
From a vineyard-only perspective, it works well, or it has worked well for us. You know, from a winemaking standpoint, then a lot of personal philosophy actually comes into play. Is Chardonnay good? Yes. Is there another white variety you like more as a winemaker, or you think shows superior characteristics in this region? Possibly. And then you make that decision. For us, that decision was Viognier, which is the only white that we do on site. We're primarily a red wine producer. You know, about 90% of our production is red. And so the original planting of what was a viable commercial venture as a standalone vineyard with no winery attached is different than what you plant for your own winery.
Let's back up to Viognier for a moment, and why do you like it?
Viognier, in addition to being probably hard to pronounce, which, you know, it looks like Viognier or Wagner, and if I'm doing a winemaker dinner or have a group here that I'm convinced may not be comfortable enough to ask for it by name, I do a little V, like the letter, own, like to buy something, and yay, like you're cheering, and see if they can come up with an approximation. But the aromatic components on Viognier, I think, rival some of the aromatics that you would be used to seeing in a Riesling or Gewürz, that very spicy, aromatic, high-toned fruit component. You know, it has nice acidity in the mouth. It's crisper and leaner than most Chardonnays, at least California-style Chardonnays. And the trick is, you know, don't bury the vineyard in a lot of new oak.
Let's go a little further inside of the winery, the process of making Viognier come out the other end. What lengths do you go to?
Well, it starts in the vineyard, and our entire vineyard, including the Viognier, is set up with VSP, vertical shoot positioning, movable catch wires. All the varieties, we do some amount of shoot thinning, cluster thinning, and leaf pulling. On the Viognier, we like to get the leaves pulled on the shade side of the vine.
So canopy management is critical, is what you're saying.
I think it is in all varieties, but particularly in Viognier, and particularly in the style that we're doing. We tend to harvest our Viognier at, well, what used to be considered fully ripe fruit. You know, in today's world, we might be on the lower end of the spectrum as far as bricks or sugar content.
Where would your bricks typically average?
We usually pick our Viognier between 23 and 23 and a half. You know, Paso Robles, with its warm day, cool night phenomenon, Viognier being an early, relatively early ripening variety, you can get Viognier super ripe if you choose to. We actually, you know, make that decision to pick it there because we think it has better acidity and flavor components. But getting that light around the fruit, we tend to have very golden fruit even at, you know, what is, you know, lower bricks numbers. So
at 23, 24, would it be naive to presume that it would come out the other end around 14%?
We're normally, alcohols are between 13 and a half on the Viognier. You know, we crowd that 23 into the 23 is like, if we picked it at 23.2 every year, that'd probably be perfect for us.
Mm-hmm. So a very drinkable wine and not a hot wine at all.
We think it's a more elegant style, brighter aromatics. It certainly has plenty of mouthfeel because what we actually do after harvest, press the clusters, whole cluster press while they're still cool, and actually go to tank, chill the juice, and go to barrels cold. And it's all barrel fermented. We use about 25 to 30% new Hungarian barrels, and the older barrels are also Hungarian oak. After fermentation, topped up at passive aging on the lees. We like that lees contact for the little richness, creaminess that you get in the mouthfeel. And no ML on the Viognier. We really want to retain that acidity, you know, until when we can bottle the wine.
Bright and crisp.
That's a good description of the Viognier.
Therefore, it follows that it would be a great wine to have on a nice sunny summer afternoon.
Absolutely. You know, if we were to pick one of our wines to do, you know, richer seafood, you know, shellfish or something that has a fair amount of oil in it, you know, richer fishes or shellfish, that's what I'd set it up with.
Let's switch to reds. Now, that's your real mainstay, and you have quite a few acres of reds growing out behind us. Tell us what you grow and why.
Well, we grow quite a variety of reds. I think we have 8 varieties. Let me see here. We have Zinfandel, classic for Paso Robles. I mean, if you're in Paso, you should be doing Zin. We do Petite Syrah. We do Syrah. And you know, we can talk further on that confusing name pairing. And then we have 5 Bordeaux Reds on site. Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, and Malbec.
So you have all the 5 classic Bordeaux. Therefore, it follows that I would assume that this, your terroir, your growing soils and weather, etc., are somewhat similar to Bordeaux.
Soils that we have here are highly calcareous, fractured shale soils. The part that's not rock is a clay loam. On this particular site, we've never had to go more than about 6 inches before we hit this fractured shale in amongst the soil. So we get good drainage. The vineyard will handle, because the fact that any water moisture in the soil drains off quickly. No one wants to talk about fall rain, but if we get some, the soils actually drain pretty quickly. The vines and the fruit managed to come through it pretty well.
Would there be a signature Victor Hugo wine?
We hope they're all signature, of course. But the wine that we do, I mean, we mentioned the 5 Bordeaux varieties. We do a Bordeaux-style blend or meritage from the 5 Bordeaux. It is called Opulence. The blend percentages on the wine will vary relatively dramatically. From vintage to vintage, what we actually do, crush, barrel ferment, and age separately for about 15 months. Then we'll do our blend decision and then back to barrels for another 9 to 10 months. So typically, Merlot is a pretty significant component of the blend. Also, Malbec is a fairly significant. And we're not patterning the blend after anything else commercially. It's merely what we feel is the most interesting, intriguing, complex blend that we can put together for the vintage.
And I presume, like you said, vintage, it changes year to year. You might shift degree of one versus another percentage-wise.
Oh, absolutely. And in vintages, when the Cab Franc on site is optimum, it's killer. Actually, in about a third of the vintage has been the biggest component of the blend. Other vintages where, you know, for whatever reason, we don't like it as well, it may be a smaller percentage than, say, the Merlot and Malbec.
Very good. I want to go on and on, but unfortunately, we're out of time. Before we go, if somebody wanted to discover Victor Hugo wines, where and how would they do that?
There's a number of retail outlets in the Central Coast that carry our wines, and I can't mention them all by name, but, you know, if that isn't convenient for you, certainly give us a call at the winery, 805-434-1128. We're small. Literally, it is myself, my wife, and that's it for the tasting room. So we've set it up by appointment. We're always glad to see people. We're just not always here.
Vic Roberts, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Vic Roberts, the owner of Victor Hugo Winery in Templeton, California. This is your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Templeton, California, where we've been speaking with Vic Roberts, the owner of Victor Hugo Winery.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.